So today, for today's talk, yesterday I was talking about some of the problems in meditation. I talked about how to calm the mind down. Now, for those of you who haven't asked the question yet, I will answer it about where does insight come into all of this? And is there such a thing as insight meditation and calm meditation? What does it really mean? So this is a talk on insight today. Now, even the very word insight, it means to see within, to see deep within. So if you're looking outside, you can't see within. So if you're looking to the past or the future, how can you see anything at all? If you look to thoughts, remember you're not seeing the sunset, you're just seeing the words which describe the sunset. So to have insight, you have to be calm and in the moment. Because if you look outside, this moment to the future or the past, what do we call that? Excite. That's where you get excited. And that's where you get big problems. So you want insight instead of excite. In other words, calm and peaceful. But there is such a thing as vipassana, and there is such a thing as samatha. And how do they relate together? And how they relate together is well explained by another little story I made up some time ago. I don't just repeat other people's stories, I actually make these up myself. I sit in my room and think, what story should I make up today? No, I don't. I just have fun. So, this particular story, for those who haven't heard it before, which is probably only one of you. But anyhow, I'll tell it. So once upon a time, there was this married couple, and they were so close, so devoted to each other. They loved each other to bits, and they were always, whenever they went anywhere, they went together. And the husband was called Sam Atta. And his wife was called Vipassana. So Sam Atta and Vipassana. Sam and Vi, after lunch one day, they decided it's such a wonderful day, they'd go for a walk. And they wanted to go for a walk to one of their favorite places, which was Meditation Mountain. Now Sam, he wanted to go up Meditation Mountain for the peace. He was so calm and still up Meditation Mountain. He loved the peace. So Sam went up the mountain for the sake of calm and peace. His wife, Vi, she just loved the incredible view on the top of Meditation Mountain. You could see the whole universe, everything was clear to you. So she went up there for the beautiful sights. And she even took her camera with her, you know, just to snap the insights, insight, insight, insight. And that's just like me a few moments ago. I was early today, so I decided just to sit quietly, you know, by the stupa, and then I turned around, click, 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 click. I get no peace. That's why I wear dark glasses sometimes. I think you might not recognize me, but it doesn't work. Anyway, back to Sam and Pai. So they went up a walk on Meditation Mountain, but they also took their dog as well. If you go for a walk, you take your dog with you. And the dog was called Metta. So Sam, Atta, Vipassana and Metta the dog, you know Metta means loving kindness, went up a walk on Meditation Mountain. And as they got higher and higher, it became more and more peaceful and you could see more. So even halfway up, Sam was so happy. He was so calm. Halfway up Meditation Mountain. And Vi, even halfway up, she could see long distances. So she's taking some shots with her camera. And as for Metta the dog, the higher Metta the dog got up Meditation Mountain, the more she wagged her tail. She was getting happier and happier. And when they got to the summit, to the top of Meditation Mountain, my goodness, it was so still. It was a peace beyond understanding. It was just incredibly silent and still and profound. It was amazing. So Sam, he enjoyed every minute of incredible peace and calm. But Sam also had a pair of eyes. So he also enjoyed the view. He could see way over there, and he could see all the distant places, and it was all clear to him, because he had a pair of eyes too. As for his wife, she was taking all these amazing photographs. You could see forever and see so clearly on the top of Meditation Mount. You're getting all these amazing insights. But she could also experience the peace. She enjoyed awe, great view, but incredible peaceful up on Meditation Mountain. And as Metta the dog, you've seen these dogs when they really get excited and really over the top happy. Not only was it wagging its tail like it was going to fall off, it was running around in circles. It was just blissed out of its little head, little Metta the dog. But even Metta the dog could enjoy the peace and see the view too. And the reason is because on the top of Meditation Mountain, the peace, the insight, and what many people forget, the joy and the metta all come together. So you may be going up Meditation Mountain like the dog, simple, just for the fun of it. The dog doesn't have any ideas. I'm going to get part and fruit, I'm going to get jhana, I'm going to get nimittas. Dogs are really smart. They're very wise. They just do things for the fun of it. As for us, we have to justify it first of all and think about it and overcome our guilt of having a good time. But as for dogs, they're very smart. So she went up there just for the fun of it. And she got so much joy and peace and insight. Because on the top of Meditation Mountain, those three all come together. Stillness, deep insight, and incredible joy. You know that sometimes, this is just anecdotal, sometimes people who do get into jhanas, and they haven't really had much training before, they fluke the jhanas. You know what sometimes they say that bliss is like? They don't call it so much bliss. Sometimes it's like pure love. And because a lot of times this is something really interesting, like real big metta. A really strong love, you know, really powerful, transcendental love. It's just so joyful and it's so peaceful. That's why, you know, those things are just so still and so joyful and so full of, you know, what love should really be. And on the question of love, I said it to this to a few people during the interviews. You know, what real love is, it's not attachment. Now that real love, opening the door of your heart, letting things be, perfectly enjoying just things being and loving them for what they are, not asking anything more, not demanding anything. And that's the ultimate love, is where peace, bliss, insight all come together. That's why many people are going to jhanas and they say, wow, there's just such a pure love. Some people say bliss, but it really is the same thing. So Metta the dog, she belongs up Meditation Mountain as well. So that is why that story I told a few days ago. If you can't do Anapanasati, don't worry about that. I will teach you breath meditation. If you can't do breath, I'll teach you metta. If you can't do metta, I'll teach you loving kindness. If you can't do loving kindness, I'll teach you samatha. If you can't do samatha, I'll teach you calm. If you can't do calm, I'll teach you vipassana. If you can't do vipassana, I'll teach you insight. Because they're all exactly the same. It's all about taking a cup, letting it go, allowing it to be still. So that the mind can experience the peace and get the deep understandings of the nature of the mind and how this whole thing works and have this beautiful sense of joy and love. So this is actually what you all experience. If you think you're going up the mountain for calm and peace, that's fine. The insights and the metta will come alongside of that if you go up Meditation Mountain. If you're going up there for insight, if you're doing vipassana, that's fine. If you do it properly, the calm will come right behind, and also the metta. Or if you're just doing it for metta, for loving kindness, then the calm and the insights, they will come also behind. Because they all belong together. You can't really separate them. What Ajahn Chah used to say, and I remember him doing this, he was asked that question, what's the difference between samatha and vipassana? And he would actually hold up his hand. And he said, look, it's the same as the front and the back of my hand. Look, now the front goes to the, so the palm of my hand goes in front. And you can only see the palm of my hand. But you know the back's there. Now you can only see the back of my hand. But you can also, I know there's the front there as well. So So it's like samatha, vipassana, samatha, vipassana. Sometimes you think you're just doing samatha because that's all you can see, but vipassana is right behind. Sometimes you think you're doing vipassana, but samatha is right behind as well. The two go together, like the front and the back of the hand. That's what Ajahn Chah always used to say. But that's me who added the metta thing, because really you have to have the metta there as well. That comes with the territory. And that's also important, because that's a good test whether you really are getting calm and you are getting insight or you are doing metta meditation. For example, if you're doing calm meditation and you're still angry and upset, you haven't got any metta, you're missing the boat. That's not calm meditation, that's usually control. That's where a person could hold their body and their mind pretty still just through willpower. They could even watch the breath for half an hour or an hour, watching every breath just through trying, through willpower. And afterwards, don't make a noise, stand up straight. They've got no metta. That's not the way to sort of develop the mind. So someone comes along and says, yes, I got in just third jhana. Sometimes as a teacher, you say, oh, that's rubbish, you haven't done that. I say, what? And if they get angry, it's like a test for them. If they get angry, then I know, yeah, they didn't get jhana. But if, it's just a test, that's all. But if they, got fourth jhana and say, women can't get jhana. And I say, okay. Then I say, okay, you may have got it. I try and stir them up. Because if they really achieve these things, number one, they'd have the peace, they'd have the metta, and they have the deep understanding. They all come together. You can't separate them. So the same with even our insight. Some people come along and say the most profound things. It really is, that's a really deep thing. But then they're sort of so angry and upset and depressed. In other words, it's just surface. It's not real insight. But if it really is insight, you really see into things. It just makes you so peaceful. And it makes you so loving. That's the nature of insight. So you know it by its results. Insight gives rise to peace and to lots of kindness. Peace gives rise to insight and lots of love. And metta gives rise to lots of peace and lots of insight. The three always go together. So that's why it's very nice to know that you don't have to make the choice. Which one should I do? Should I do vipassana? Should I do insight? Should I do vipassana? Should I do samatha? Should I do metta? It gets so confusing, doesn't it? Which one should you do? And sometimes people say, okay, I've done samatha, now when can I do vipassana? Oh, old dummy. Look, you don't do anything. You do samatha, or samatha happens, vipassana happens as a natural course. It's just what occurs. Now with insight, especially I'm just focusing on that part of the path, I like to differentiate two types of insight, and that's the insight in how to meditate. In other words, how to get still and deep and peaceful. And also the insight into, say, the meaning of life. Now, the insight in how to do it, and the insight what you find at the end of the path. But you know, the two are the same. I just differentiate those because it makes it easy to understand at the beginning. But afterwards you find, actually, how you meditate is actually the meaning of life. So, the insights which you get on how to meditate, that's what I've been talking about all week so far. All the difficult problems in meditation, especially just to see how the wanting causes you so much difficulty in the meditation. And how when you can sit down and just do nothing, be perfectly content, just be in the moment, not wanting anything in the world, just happy to be here. You don't have to be perfect or healthy or sort of without any coughing. I saw a few of you cough, so out of compassion I cough with you. And so you don't have to be perfect, perfectly healthy to be able to get some deep meditation. That's one of the reasons why that sometimes you think, Ajahn Brahm, I mean, you're not like other monks. You don't tell us to sit still for hours. You don't tell us to come at a certain time. You're just so soft. You're so loose. Is there something wrong with you? And one, this is just key experiences which I had in my life. There was that one occasion where I had typhus fever. Well, actually, it's scrub typhus. same thing really, scrub typhus in northeast Thailand for about 2 or 3 weeks in the hospital. And you know, it was very, very, very unpleasant. This was in 1974 or 5 or something, a third world country. And at that time, Thailand was very poor. And the northeast was the backwater, the whoop-whoops, as they say in Australia, of Thailand. And in those days, that they didn't really know, they didn't actually know what we had. They didn't thought it was some sort of disease or fever, and they couldn't understand what it was. So they just give you this cocktail of antibiotics, injected into your buttocks, twice a day. Now, you might think that's not so bad, but remember, those were the days where needles were recycled. So they were used in Bangkok first, because it's a poor country. And then they were sent up to the northeast where the poor farmers lived. And last of all, it was used for the tough guys, the monks. Now, I mean, that's not a joke, because the nurse who used to come in twice a day to inject my bum, she was built like a water buffalo. Not some petite thing that, you know, you see yourself on the aircraft. She was this really strong, you know, would make Margaret Thatcher look like a wimp. And she didn't inject you. It wasn't sort of, you know, rub some things on and just very quietly. It was stabbing you. And now it is true. And with the best meta in the world, after 3 days, I hated that nurse. And every time you show up, I think, oh no. And your bottom really hurt after a while. And no worse than that, you had a terrible fever and you had no energy at all. You know, even to go to the toilet. Now, no bedpans. So the toilet was in the end of the ward. And, you know, the lucky monks were next to the toilet. I was about 5 or 6 beds away. And, you know, it was like an expedition out Mount Everest to get to that toilet. And as soon as you got there, you stayed there until you did your business, because you didn't want to do that too many times a day. So, that was, I felt really awful. I mean, and one day, I felt so bad. Those of you who had fevers, you know, a long way from home, you start getting depressed, you start getting miserable, everything is sore, nothing is really working. No sort of entertainment or anything to take away sort of, you know, the constant sort of, you know, really no energy. I mean, really no energy. It's really hard even just to move your head, let alone get up. And no one to look after you. No nurses coming around to see if you're okay. You know, and even the people in the next bed, they can hardly understand, you know, because your tie was terrible. And after all of that, I thought, and so, you know, I said, well, I had an idea. Why don't meditate? You know, I never thought about that, because I always thought, if you're really weak, if you have fever, if you're hurting, if you're in pain, you can't meditate. So I really had no choice. Let's give it a try. So I closed my eyes, and I meditated. I had this incredibly beautiful deep meditation. And you know, if you ever get a deep meditation here, that's blissful enough. But the comparison, you know, beforehand, my body was a mess. And it was just so aching and so tired and hurting all over. And now you get a deep meditation, no body, and blissed out. That was really neat. I wish everyone could do that in hospital. And when I came out afterwards, I felt great. But what I really noticed, I looked at my posture. And in all the meditation manuals I've ever read, I've never ever seen a posture like that in my life. Now the legs were all over the place, and arm this way. You know, if you've been in bed for a long time, sometimes your posture goes all over the place. And that actually taught me, I said, my God, I just got into a really deep meditation in this posture. It taught me that posture is totally irrelevant. You know, how you actually arrange your body, it's got no magic there. Somebody asked me, you know, do you have to press the tongue at the tip of your the top of your mouth? Do you have to put your hands in a certain way to get the energy going? Look, I didn't know where my tongue was. It's probably hanging out the corner of my mouth. And my hands had no mudra at all, no position. But you got a deep meditation. You proved something. That there's so much superstition in Buddhism, and you prove it. No, it's not necessary at all. That's why one of the great things about Buddhism coming to Western countries, you know, is we've been trained to challenge. And a lot of time in Asia, you just follow what your teacher says. If the teacher says it, it must be right. But you know, in the West, we challenge. And that's actually really, really good for Buddhism. It's making these great new insights into what's actually real Buddhism is. And things like how to meditate. Opening meditation up to all sorts of people. Instead of just, you know, some people who could do it, if they could sit perfectly still for hours on end, many times a day. So anyone can meditate now. So, the insight which comes up is, first of all, the insight into the posture. Now that was a powerful insight, understanding the posture is not important at all. However you make yourself comfortable, that is enough. And also understanding just why can't my mind be still? Why can't I let go? So you get real insights there. And this is where I've been really pushing this point for years and years and years. You get into deep meditation, you get enlightened, not through willpower, but through wisdom power. The wisdom is far, far stronger than any willpower. You screw up your will and say, right, this is it, I'm going for it. Okay, no more messing around. I'm going to sit here right now. Forget about lunch. Forget about interviews. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to beat my mind to a pulp. You know, there's some people who are like that. Now, there are. I mean, I really admire, you know, their endurance. And I could never do that. But I also realize they're very stupid. It's the wisdom power. It's far stronger and more effective. And that's actually why, you know, the Buddha prays wisdom power more than anything else. It's the wisdom power which works, which means use your insight. So you come across a problem and you understand it. I think I told this story at Nolamara just a couple of Fridays ago. And this is, for the Thai tradition, this is a very powerful story. And after 5 years as a monk, I went visiting all these other great Thai teachers, including Ajahn Mahabua, who is one of the most famous of the Thai teachers. And when I came there, after a couple of days, you know, the word went around, there was a talk that night. So I came along, and my Thai was pretty perfect by that time. Now, it's gone down a bit, because I haven't used it so much. But those days I was giving talks in Thai, and people were really getting into them. But I listened to Ajahn Mahabua, and he said, this is for the Western monk who's just come, and that was me. And he gave this talk. It was translated afterwards, but the translation wasn't much good. I preferred it in the Thai, because you could really understand it much better. And one of the core messages there was where Ajahn Mahabua was telling a story when he was a young monk with his teacher, Ajahn Mun. And he had malaria fever. And most of the monks in those days got malaria. It was just part of the course because you were living in the jungles. And he was right in the middle of a malaria fever. You know, just feeling really weak, shaking, a very high temperature. Now most people, just about 99.999% of people just lay down and rest. But this guy, Ajahn Mahabua, he was the tough monk. He's supposed to be the toughest monk in the whole of Thailand. At least he used to be, but he's dead now. But he decided, no, I'm not going to give in to this fever. I'm going to fight it. So he has got incredible willpower. He forced his body up from the bed. You know, put some clothes on. And picked up a broom, and they went down below and picked up a broom and helped all the mother monks doing their duties of doing the sweeping in the afternoon. Shaking with fever, stumbling, but still managing to sweep. Now, most people say, wow, what a hero, what a strong monk. When Ajahn Mun saw him, you idiot, you fool. He said, that is not the way of Buddhism, to fight. So the way of Buddhism is to investigate. Go back upstairs, lay down, and investigate your illness. Understand it. Don't fight it. And always remember that. The same if you have any problems in your meditation. Don't fight it. Understand it. Investigate it. Get wisdom power. So you get really frustrated. You get bored. You've been coming to this retreat year after year after year and you still haven't got any peace. Stop fighting. Understand what's going on. Why? Use your intelligence. Use your wisdom power. Find out. And that's actually why we really use insights to overcome all these defilements. Not willpower. And the biggest problem with many people, especially people who have been brought up with Western culture, they come across an obstacle and they just punch harder and harder and harder. And all they get is sore hand. It's crazy. Instead of punching at the wall, you stand back. You know, a lot of times this has happened in my meditation. You come across a brick wall in meditation, you can't go through it. So what do? I stand back. You know what I find? There's a door just over there. There's a ladder just over there. You just need to get a bigger view and then you see the way around it. So, use your insight, use your wisdom power. So, all the defilements which is coming up in your meditation, why you can't go deeper? Stand back and just have a look. Use wisdom power. And you always find, every time, there's some sort of desire, some sort of wanting, some sort of controlling going on. That's the reason why you don't get deep. Some sort of expectation is one of the forms of wanting you've got to be really careful with. Especially those of you who've had good experiences in the past. You know, you had a really nice experience. Are you really close? This is it, this is it, this is it. You've blown it again. So you realise that I told this to people because the same thing happened to me when I was a young lay person and got my first big experience. It took me about 2 or 3 years to get back to those nice experiences. You know, you had a taste of bliss. And you get close, you want it again. So what I've understood, I use my wisdom power, realize, look, your job as a meditator is to forget about the results and to put all your energy into creating the causes. Forget about paths and fruits, so on, jhanas, nimittas, or whatever. Forget about the results. Put the causes in place. What creates a nimitta? What's a cause for a jhana? What actually do you have to do for path and fruit, for enlightenment? I already mentioned that to you earlier in that beautiful simile by Ajahn Chah of the mango orchard. Don't shake the mango tree. Don't climb it. Don't throw any sticks up to try and get things. Open your hand. Be still and mango will fall in. And that's wisdom power. So no expectations. Put the causes in place. Causes. Being kind. Being gentle. Making peace. Letting go. Contentment. Just being happy to be here. Those are where we focus our attention in meditation. It's not what you're watching, what you're observing. You may be in a nimitta or in a sexual fantasy. I don't care. What I really care about is how you're relating to that, what you're doing with it. Are you fighting your sexual fantasy? Or are you making peace with it, being kind, being gentle? Are you getting excited about your nimitta? Or are you making peace, being kind, being gentle? You put causes into place. You create the causes. That's your work. The results come by themselves. You are responsible for the causes. And that's all you need to do. Once you get the causes in place, you build them up. Many moments of peace, many moments of kindness, many moments of gentleness. You keep all those causes in place. It's only a matter of time. It happens. But it doesn't happen every time. This is the story I told to many people during the interviews. Sometimes I ask people to please write them on a piece of paper, then I can answer them. Actually, I shouldn't say that because there's too many questions on the piece of paper last night. Maybe come to the interviews instead. But they say, I got a really good meditation, but the next one was awful. What's going on? Why is that the case? You can sit here and get beautiful meditation. I've got it now. The next one is terrible. And the reason is this. It's the story of the man who went to work on a Monday morning. He really worked hard. And at the end of the day, he didn't get any pay. He went home. His wife said, "How did you go? How much did you make today?" He said, "Nothing. I never got paid at all." So he went again to work on a Tuesday. Same thing happens. Worked all day and got no pay. So he didn't really feel like going to work on a Wednesday, you know, but his wife forced him to, so off he went. Same thing happened, no work, no pay on Wednesday. And Thursday, the same. Worked all day and got no pay. And then he went to work on a Friday, and after the working on a Friday, his boss gave him a big pay packet. And he went home and told his wife, "From now on, darling, I'm only going to work on Fridays." Now you can understand what's going on there. You get paid on Friday, not just for the work you did on Friday, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday as well. So you don't get a good meditation, every meditation. But when you do, it's not just because of the work you've done in this meditation where you get the bliss. It's a paycheck because you've built up all these courses, many meditations after the other. You've made so much peace, you've made so much kindness, so much gentleness, now you get the paycheck. And that's actually how it works. So your job is just to create the causes. And the results come. Now that is wisdom power. And that is actually what I mean, like insight. All this wanting, all this expectation. Look, another type of insight, which is really important for meditation, is what I call the two types of waiting. Or the two types of patience. Because we're all supposed to be patient, aren't we? But you're not. Because when you are think you're being patient, all you're really doing is waiting for something to happen. You're waiting in the future. So you wait here and say, "Okay, I'm making peace, I'm being kind, being gentle. It's not happening yet. Come on. I'm being kind, being peaceful, being gentle. I've been doing this for 6 days now." Now you understand, that's called waiting in the future. You're waiting for something to happen. It's expectations. And much of the time, that's what we do. We're waiting for the bus to arrive. We're waiting for our appointment to come up and the doctor to call us in. You know, we're waiting for jhana to appear. We're always waiting in the future. And that's one of the insights which comes up, which shows you you're waiting in the wrong place. That's not patience, that's desire again. That's expectation. So you change to wait in the present. So in other words, like I'll use the word wait and I change it around its meaning around, like the waiter in a restaurant. A waiter in a restaurant who becomes very successful and gets big tips is always in the present moment. He looks at that table and looks at that table. But when he sees, you know, the glass is half empty, then he goes and fills it up. He's always alert. If he's waiting for something to happen, he won't be seeing what's happening right now. So you wait in the moment, not in the future. And there's like little insights which come up to see how you meditate. And the brilliant thing about these insights, you're meditating, you're getting nowhere, and you get this insight, now I know what I mean by waiting in the moment rather than waiting in the future. You see it, and straight away you get deep. It's like as soon as you see the problem, it vanishes, and you just go into a deeper state of meditation. Or for example, just when you do get nimittas. When a nimitta comes up, this beautiful light comes up into your mind. Now for me it was always moving around. And I thought, I can't stop this nimitta, so come and stop so it can actually get, you know, deep and bright and help get the jhanas. And it was all moving all over the place. And I thought, what the hell's going on? So I never use willpower to try and grab hold of that nimitta with my will and stay still. Because that just made it move more and more. So the insight was that what actually is that? What's going on? And after a while I realized what I was watching, that light in my mind, was literally a reflection of my own mind. Like looking at your face in the mirror in the morning. The image you see in that mirror is you, your face. So if you know you need a shave, you can see it in the mirror. That's the image of you. And that's exactly what that nimitta was. It was the image of the mind, the citta. And I should have known that because it said it in the Anapanasati Sutta, in the chittang patisangvedi, you experience the citta in that stage of meditation when the breath disappears. You should have known it because a favorite phrase is, this mind is pabhasara, you know, when all the defilements aren't there at that particular stage. And it does become a brilliant, radiant mind. That's how you experience it. Incredible light, brilliant, you know, shining. It's radiant. That's what the word it means. So you see this, you experience it, there it is. But why was it moving? And of course, through staying with the thing and developing the insight, I soon realized it's moving because I'm moving. And the same in the mirror. If you see that image in the mirror when you're trying to shave, you see it moving backwards and forwards. It's not the mirror's fault, as I said earlier. It's the person watching's fault. So if I wanted that image in the mirror to be still, I had to be still. The one who was watching. And so when the nimitta came up, I made sure the one who was watching was perfectly still. And then the nimitta became still. That solves a huge amount of problems at that stage in the meditation. And of course, that's exactly what Ajahn Chah used to say. You're watching the animals in still forest pool simile. The one who was watching had to be still. Then the animals would come out and stay. So this is where you get the insights into the way of meditation. But as you go deeper, you get into these jhanas. This is where you get the big insights. First of all, you have to have the insight in how to meditate. So you get in these stages to begin with, to get all the tricks, to understand what's going on and why. Why can't you be that still that you can get into these jhanas? You have to stop controlling, really let go. Jhanas are what happens when you're not doing things. They're stages of letting go. The more you let go, the closer you get to the jhanas. That's one of the reasons why you can't really be attached to the jhanas. You can't be attached and letting go at the same time. It's what happens when you let go. If you want them, no way will they happen. You just let go, put the causes in place, and they just happen. They just come. You don't chase them, you sit still, they come to you. And when they do come, well, first of all, I should mention that one of the great insights which will come up, that on the different stages of meditation, especially when you go deep, you will come across the barrier of fear. I love talking about fear because fear is such a huge part of our inner experience. And you know, you can give talks and talks and talks about the nature of fear. But in this particular case, when you get very deep, the fear comes up because it's showing you what fear truly is. Fear is what happens when you're about to let go of something you really cherish, especially something which you think belongs to you or is part of you. That's what fear is. So some of you have already been afraid just when your breath disappears. Ah, I'm going to die. Oh, it doesn't matter, you're going to die anyway. Get it out of the way. And it's the most wonderful place to die, you know, in a retreat center, doing a meditation retreat. This is to be so auspicious if you die on this retreat. You know, you've got a great monk and other monks and nuns here with you at the time that really inspire. You're talking about that guy, you know, who tried to get Buddha Dhamma Sangha just before he died. You've got it right in front of you. You know, you're sweet. You have to go to heaven or a better place. But what we're really doing there is we get so afraid of losing something and we're not ready to let it go yet. You know, our life, our body, our breath. So it's something which you're attached to is about to go. Fear comes up in many times. Even in the beginning part, there was this one guy in Singapore, you know, I started teaching him meditation and he came up to me and said, "I'm terrified. What happened? You know, did you get jhanas or something?" He said, "No, my hand started to vanish." That's the easy one. You can have trouble when your whole mind starts to disappear. But you know, because he'd been so attached to his body, the idea of his not being able to feel his hands was something he thought was really weird and strange. So fear actually comes up when you're letting go. So when that fear does come up, brilliant, well done. That is a great sign. You're actually getting to the what I call the cold face of insight. Real insight, where you're seeing what you're really attached to. The fear is a sign
This is what I'm really attached to because it's being taken away from me. And have a bit of faith, a confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, and in all the sort of monks and nuns you've met who continually tell you, please let go. Is the bliss better than sex? This body sucks. You know, let it go for goodness sake. Have a break. Have a holiday. My body is over 60 years and it's pretty good shape for a 60-year-old, but still, you know, the nose itches, you know, I want to go to the toilet, the legs ache, you know, and sometimes you don't let me go to the toilet because, you know, I try and get up doing interviews and then the next one comes and the next one comes and the next one comes. Oh! It's okay, I don't mind. I've been well trained. So, all of these body, and it's brilliant when it goes and disappears. So have some faith to please let go. Letting go is sweet. It's beautiful. So when the fear comes, oh, the hell with fear, I'm just going to go for it. Are you really willing to sacrifice everything for truth? For what's real and meaningful? Some people aren't. They'd rather be ignorant and stupid and feel safe. But really, those of you who are really into, you know, finding what nirvana is, finding out what the truth really is, you've got to be willing to sacrifice. And actually, you don't really sacrifice anything really worthwhile. All you let go of is a bunch of shit. So you just let go of this body. And when it goes, it's brilliant. It's so peaceful. It's so nice. So when things disappear, if this fear comes up, insight is necessary now. What are you afraid of losing? And after all, nothing, I don't really own this anyway. Off you go, disappear. And you go to the next level. So the body disappears. You've still got the breath though. And then the breath disappears. And people get pretty much afraid then. They know what's going on because all of your experience so far has always been with the body and being able to do things. And now it's all gone. You're just in the mind. It's a bit freaky at first and scary, but it's a great place to hang out. I recommend it. So you just let go and you go into this beautiful mind. It's peaceful, it's beautiful. A bit weird, but nice. But really what comes up next is the fear just before jhanas. Because what you have to let go of is that thing I said the other day, will. Now you really have to let go of control. And it literally is like you're driving in the heavy traffic on the freeway. You're the driver. And the monk tells you, or the nun, take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, hand off the gear stick, in the middle of traffic going 100 kilometers an hour. I'm going to crash! It's all going to go wrong! If it was real traffic, yeah, it would go wrong. But the simile holds for meditation. You really have to take your hand off the wheel and stop controlling. Take your finger off the mouse and stop clicking things. If you can do that, then the jhana happens. If you even just hold your hand on the mouse to click just in case, then it won't happen. You really have to let go. And this insight that really what you're letting go of is all this, what the Buddha said before, the sense of self, the sense of me. And if you can just go a little bit further and go into the jhana, you realize that that's what you've let go of. You've let go of control. You let go of this thing which is always running your life. Always deciding what you're going to eat, what you're going to do, what you're going to say, where you're going to put your hand. All of that is gone. Good riddance. It's scary because we look at our will as something which has been protecting us and serving us. You've used your will, your choice, to actually to create your wealth, your health and your happiness, your house. You've worked so hard, you've been so successful, and now this monk is coming up and saying, stop it, let it go. It's a tough call, but you do that and you bliss out. How else can you be really peaceful and still when there's a will always disturbing you? I call the will like this guard in the prison, never allowing the prisoner to sit still a moment. Come on, get up, don't do this, do that, do this. But always telling you what to do. You experience that. It's called restlessness in meditation. You can't just sit here. You've got to do something. And even if you've got your eyes closed, you've got to do jhana, you've got to do vipassana, you've got to do samadhi, you've got to do metta, you've got to do something. And Ajahn Mom says, letting go. Okay, we're going to do letting go now. Crazy people. It's that doing which you stop, and that's a tough call to do. But the insight comes, that is the essence, or half the essence, of understanding anatta, non-self. Someone was asking me about rebirth and the self, reincarnation of the self last night, and I gave a simile of the manga. So take it deeper, when there's a doer, when you're doing things, you're creating, you are creating your next birth. When the doer stops, you don't do anything. When the will, the creator stops, then of course, rebirth ends. Sankara, pachaya, vijnana, independent origination. From the sankharas, it gives rise to the rebirth consciousness. Sankharas are the doers, the creators, the makers. That's why one of the great sayings of the arahats, the great sages, said, house builder, you have been seen. Your rafters have been destroyed. You will build no more houses for me. You know what that house builder is? Your will, the doer. And it's weird to let that one go. It's impossible to will it to go. That's more willing. But there is a path, and it's the path of these jhanas based on insight. The will stops, and that's weird. The strangest thing about this is the simile for the deep insight, the best I could ever come up with, to show you what's really going on. I've been talking about this will for the last 5 or 10 minutes, but you don't understand a word of what I've said, because you haven't got a clue what this will means. To prove that, we use a simile of the tadpole. The tadpole is born in water, lived all its life in water, and went to school and studied water, and heard all these lectures on water by these great professors, and even did Abhidharma classes in water. But do you think a tadpole could ever understand what water is? He'd been born in water, it's all around him. He's never had a moment experience when he wasn't in water. How could you understand what water is? But one day, little tadpole sprouted some legs, and she became a frog. And one day the frog jumped out of the lake for the first time. Now that was really weird. For the first time in its conscious memory, the tadpole, now a frog, was dry. There was something missing. Something which had always been there had gone. Ah, that's what water is. That thing which is now missing. Only a frog can understand what water was. Tadpole never can. Can you understand what will is? You've been immersed in it ever since you were born, in your previous lives as well, between lives. It's always been there for you. Yes, sometimes you haven't used it, but it's still been there for you, at your fingertips. And for the first time when you get into these jhanas, it's gone. That's weird. That's spooky. That's freaky. That's one of the reasons why it's so scary to get into the jhanas. Body is easy to let go of compared to your will, because you identify with your will so strongly. That's part of you. I mean, really part of you. Part of your essence. And now you're abandoning it. But when you do, bliss, peace. This will isn't bothering me anymore. It's not telling me what to do. You can really be still. So this is actually what happens. Ajahn Chah used to describe it like a person was born with a rope around their neck, pulled by these two monsters. They're invisible monsters, though. And it's called like and dislike. Yeah. But you were born like that. You lived all your life like that. You got used to it. It's normal. And one day, those two monsters, for the first time, they let go of the rope. I can breathe. This is what it's like to breathe. It's amazing. I never realized that was possible. That's like letting go of the will. At last, you're free. Of this thing always pulling you, pushing you, making you do this, making that, never allowing you to be still. But when that will goes, peace at last. So now you understand what the will is. Now these are the deep insights. The sorts of things which when you come out afterwards, you spit out. You used to have this word when in my generation, because you know, all these people were taking LSD and stuff. I never did. I was a good monk. Good man, sorry. Good young man. But they always used to say, blow your mind. You know, with these the drugs. They used to be the same. You remember those of my generation? Blow your mind. That's what actually what happens in meditation. It blows your mind because it's totally different than anything you've ever expected or experienced before. That's why it gives you the data. The raw experience on which the powerful insights are built. Now you know what water is. Now you know what the will is. As you go deeper in those jhanas, the reason why there's not just one jhana but many jhanas is because the thing which disappears next is your mind, the knower. Do you know what consciousness is? That's why that you know I read all these books and with the best will in the world, all these neuroscientists trying to discover what the nature of the mind is. No way can they ever get close to the nature of the mind. It's just theories, it's just ideas, it's just speculation. It's not based on real experience of seeing your mind vanish. If you experience your mind vanishing, just like the tadpole and the frog, now I know what this mind is, this knowing. So that is where you get the great insights. So these are the insights, the powerful ones into anatta. Who you really are, or rather, who you thought you were, but aren't. This knower and this doer. The person who is looking at me right now. The person who's observing their thoughts. The person who's feeling their body. What is that? Don't even try to figure it out. You'll be unable to. No more than a tadpole can figure out the nature of water. But when that disappears, then you get an idea. That's called insight. That's how you break through these delusions. Not through thinking, not through just inference, not just through adding one and one and thinking it's two. It's wrong. One and one don't make two. Do they? So after a while, you get these great experiences. They blow your mind. You see things totally different. And that's the stuff of enlightenment. That's what Buddhism is all about. That's insight and how it happens. And it's fun. Remember I said, at the top of the mountain, it's not just peaceful. It's not just incredible insights. You understand things. You can see the whole landscape laid out in front of you. It's also full of joy and happiness and love. So if you find any enlightened person who's a misery guts, who's grumpy and angry, no way. It's like an Ajahn Chah, kind, joyful, having a great time. That's a sign of insight. Not just being a smart aleck, always being able to sort of, you know, say incredibly profound things. Many people can do that. It's actually living them and being peaceful. So that is insight for you. Is that okay? It better be, because that's all you're getting. Come on. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.